This is Meredith for Real, the Curious Introvert, and I'm Meredith. Here we explore the taboo, less obvious, and paradoxical aspects of society. Questions you think but don't ask. Questions that need nuanced answers, not just Google results. These are the conversations you thought you'd never get to have. And the goal? To inspire curiosity over judgment. Each episode is different, so bring your ADD and your earbuds and have a look around. Before we get into it, I want to remind you that if you're listening to this on Google Podcasts, you won't be able to for much longer. Sometime this month, March 2024, the app will be discontinued and you won't be able to get any new episodes. So I would recommend trying out CastBox or GoodPods instead. You can even export your whole subscription list into the new app. This week's episode is remastered from the early days. I was inspired to bring it back because a listener in my Facebook group said it was her absolute favorite. Listeners in the group help shape the show and participate in giveaways. So if that's your vibe, I'd love to have you. It's free. You can request to join by going to facebook.com/groups/MFR Curious Insiders, or you can just click the link in the episode description. This episode is like a behind the scenes of summiting Mount Everest. I think you'll love the way my guest shares not only the physical preparations, but also what even motivated her to do this with a training window of just weeks instead of months, and how her motivation aligned with the religion of her Sherpa guide. Also, be sure to follow her on socials as she has some new adventures in the works. If you end up liking this episode, you'll also like the one I did with a travel writer who found out her travel plans were canceled, Corona canceled, that is, mid-flight, and ended up being stuck in the country of Georgia. That is episode 50. All right, friends, keep it curious. Over 200 people have died trying to do what our next guest did. A dozen died the year she did it. We're talking about summiting Mount Everest. That's making it to the top, not just climbing. Located on the border of China and Nepal, it's the highest mountain in the world. At over 29,000 feet above sea level, it's almost cruising altitude for a commercial airplane. So imagine being in the window seat and being eye to eye with a climber. At age 38 and only 8 weeks of training, she became one of 4,700 people to achieve this and only one of 605 women. Today, she's going to share how she went from non-athletic theater nerd to mountaineer, and what you don't know about what it takes to get there. Stay to the end where she will share why it's never too late to start at the bottom. Three-time Iron Woman, pediatric RN, loves Jesus and loves to party. Mary Morgan Hulatic Henderson. That is a long name,
I know,
sister.
It's a whole lot of names. There's actually more.
Oh, God.
It's a shortened version.
I'd just be signing my name M.
M-M.
M-M-H-H. That's why I only sign my name Meredith. There's no, like, that's it. I'm like Madonna. So 9 years ago, you had never even run a mile.
No, I was not very athletic. When I lived in Hawaii, I lived there for nursing school, and I was outside all the time. Like, we would go to the beach, go surfing, body surfing, that kind of stuff. But no, I was not a runner, swimmer, biker, mountain climber, nothing like that. We did a lot of hiking, but totally different than mountain climbing.
So what changed that made you do your first anything competitive like that?
I think nursing really changed my attitude on life. Just seeing, I became a pediatric nurse. So just seeing kids suffering and kids that would never make it out of the hospital made me really realize how important life is. And it's just like a precious gift, and to just really take advantage of every moment, because, you know, life is a gift and you're not promised tomorrow. And to just take advantage of our able bodies and to enjoy nature and all that God's blessed us with.
It's funny that you say take advantage of our able bodies, because when you said that the patients had inspired you to live life to the fullest, I was thinking to myself, sister, there's other ways to live life to the fullest.
Right.
But when you put it in perspective of your abled bodiness, that is amazing, because that makes it click for me. Like, yeah, you are able to do things and you should experience them to their fullest. And
what's not fuller than Mount Everest? So what went into the process of like preparing for that? I know you only had a short window of training, which is not recommended, but you did have to prepare.
Yeah, absolutely. So Everest is my third of the seven summits. I had done Aconcagua, which is the largest mountain outside the Himalayas, standing at around 23,000 feet. And I had done Kilimanjaro, which is amazing and wonderful, but it's more like a longer walk. Would definitely recommend it to anyone that is just starting out in mountaineering or just wanting to be outdoors and experience a different culture. It's beautiful and amazing. But for Everest, I called my guide from Aconcagua and asked him if he was taking a team up this last year. And he said yes. And he, you know, they do everything through WhatsApp. So he called and left me kind of like a voice message and was like, yeah, you did great on Aconcagua. I think Everest would be a good next step for you. And then, you know, blah, 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 blah. You need to train about 4 to 6, 7 months. You're talking about 2020, right? And I was like, wait, no, I meant this year.
This spring, actually.
This is literally like a year ago this time, last January. So he was like, okay, well, I'm actually not going this year. We're doing K2, but I can put you in touch with another guy that I would trust with my life. And he's actually with me on Aconcagua right now. So he put me in touch with Arnold Koster, who is from the Netherlands, but lives in Nepal. He's actually married to a Sherpa woman.
Wow.
And he's done quite a few of the 8,000 meter peaks in Nepal. So he put me in contact with him and he had room on his team. So that started the eight to 10 weeks of training that I had. And so, yeah, it was very unorthodox. Basically, I got in contact with Uphill Athlete and they put me on like a training schedule. I would just get on a treadmill with like a 50 to 60 pound pack and just walk for 3 to 6 hours on a 15% incline.
What?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Are you serious? Really boring.
We don't have any mountains here in Florida. So,
like a serious treadmill, like just.
Just up. Or I'd run stairs with a weighted vest. So pretty much that's what my life was for about 8 weeks before Everest.
Wow. Okay, I did not expect that at all. So you watched a lot of Netflix, probably.
A lot of Netflix. I watched every documentary, every movie on Everest while I was training.
Was that helpful or watching all those documentaries, did that plant seeds of fear at all or just make you more excited?
No, it just made me really excited to get there. Yeah.
So when you say I called my guy, are you talking about the guide that you used on the previous climbs?
Max Mokosh is one of the biggest climbers in Argentina, South America area. He's summited more 6,000 meter peaks than anyone else in the world. He's like Guinness Book of World Records, amazing climber. So he took me on to the top of Aconcagua, and he is the guy I called, and he put me in touch with my guide for Nepal. So,
and you didn't go with anyone; you went by yourself.
Yeah. So I went and met all the team in Kathmandu in Nepal.
Did you tell your family you were going to do this?
Yeah, sort of. So I signed up before I even told anyone, and then I kind of told my sisters and my parents. And my mom didn't speak to me for like over a month. And my sisters were all like, you're crazy. And then finally, when I met with my dad, we had dinner in Dallas. And he said, okay, I'm supposed to try and talk you out of going to do this, but I know you're going to do it. So just enjoy it.
Because it wasn't like it was your first mountain that you were summiting.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, they had to expect at some point.
Maybe. I don't know if they were ever thinking I would do Everest, but I knew I was going to do it. I told my fiance when I met him, or he's my husband now, but we've been together for 8 years. And when I met him, I was like, this is going to happen at some point. So
prepare yourself.
Yeah, just it's going to happen.
What kind of equipment did you have to buy?
So I had a lot of stuff that I've been kind of collecting through the years and through other climbs. And I climb in the summer in Colorado and sometimes in North Carolina. So I had a lot of stuff. And then for cold weather, I had stuff from Kilimanjaro and a lot of stuff from Aconcagua. But a lot of like roping, like rope stuff and a jumar, which I didn't have too much.
Wait, what is that?
It's like kind of like a handle like this that you use to climb up on a fixed rope. So had to get one of those, had my crampons, you know, all the fun stuff for cold weather climbing. But the The main thing I needed for Everside didn't have was the down suit, and my guy let me borrow one. They're really expensive. So it was brand new. It hadn't been used, but he let me use one of his. So that was awesome because they're not cheap and they're actually a pretty important piece of equipment.
Yeah. So that's so you don't freeze to death.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nice. Did you have to wear an oxygen mask past the death zone, it's called,
yes,
right?
Yes, into the death zone. So we started using supplemental oxygen at camp above Camp 1, which is about 23,000 feet. Some people slept with oxygen at Camp 1, but I didn't. And then we started using it up to Camp 2, Camp 3, and then through the summit.
Because you only get so much, usually, unless you're like paying for some prestige package, right?
Right.
So
right.
Why sleep with it?
Yeah, there's only so many bottles. So when you're at Camp 1, you usually don't sleep with it.
Yeah, that's not advised.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
you got hooked up with a Sherpa there. And what did all this cost? Because obviously not a lot of people do this. There's a lot of equipment. Do you have like a tally?
Yeah, I think with everything, it was around 50 to 60,000.
That's a lot.
So yeah, it was a lot. The once on lifetime kind of thing. I knew like if I didn't summit this year, there's no going back. So
true.
You have to keep that in mind when doing it. I mean, there are people that have, like, I guess, a lot of more resources than I do monetarily, mm-hmm. that can just spend $60,000 year after year to try, but I could not.
Right.
So failure was not an option.
So that was a motivator.
Yeah, for sure.
Were you thinking about the kids at all when you were hiking up there?
Oh, absolutely. I have, I obviously, like, all my patients are really special, but there are some kids that just stick out in my mind over the years that I constantly was thinking about. And then my nephew, Gabe, actually has cerebral palsy, so his mind is completely sharp, but he was born at 25 weeks, so he can't use the left side of his body. And if you talked to him or saw him, you wouldn't know it. He thinks he can just do everything. So he's absolutely amazing. So, you know, just thinking about him and, yeah.
When I was reading about all of this, I was reading about the Sherpas and how their religion is really passive and nothing is about self, and that it's against their religion to like pray for themselves. They only pray for others. And so being a Sherpa, guiding others to their, because they consider the mountain sacred.
Right.
That is an act of worship to help others. And what was so poignant to me is that so many of the female climbers that I researched were doing it for a cause, whether it was women's rights or because of a loved one who had passed, or for you, you had these cancer patients in mind. So I thought that was really interesting that the female approach was so aligned with the Sherpas.
Yeah, the Sherpa culture is absolutely amazing. So I think some people equate Sherpa with just like someone that gets you up the mountain, but actually there are people, they're all the whole community, their last name is Sherpa. They do not all climb
It's a people
mountains.
Group.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Karma, my Sherpa, was absolutely amazing. And when you go to Everest, you don't know who is going to be your Sherpa for the actual summit day. So you kind of get to know all of them, but Karma was the Sherpa boss, basically. He was in charge of all the Sherpas. So I didn't know if he would actually be summiting or if he would stay with Arnold and kind of just make sure that everything was going well and, you know, everyone was taken care of, because our guide did not summit this year. He stayed at Advanced Base Camp and just kind of make sure that everyone is moving and advancing and coming down that needs to, you know, at the right pace. So I didn't know until our like final summit push that Carl was actually going to be with me. And it was like such an answered prayer, because he had been kind of with us the whole trip. I mean, he definitely been with all of us the whole trip, but he'd been with me on my really hard days and days I was struggling, and we just had really bonded. So I was really hoping that he would be with me. And then he was. So it was awesome.
That's amazing. They had some really tragic stuff happen in the Sherpa community in, I think, 2014.
Yes.
Like 14 or 16 Sherpas died. I guess they're called the Ice Doctors. They go to that.
The Kumba Ice Fall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they basically make it passable for everybody.
Right. So on the south side in Nepal, the Ice Doctors go and test all the ropes and ladders and everything to make sure that They're safe for clients. And then on the north side, we have the Chinese rope fixing team. I went from the north side. So the Chinese rope fixing team goes ahead of you and fixes the ropes. And that was a big struggle this year on both sides. The weather window did not permit either team to go up ahead of time and fix the ropes. So then when there was even the chance to go higher, there were no ropes. So it was a lot of waiting this year and then a very short weather window. I think it was just the 22nd to the 24th. So most people tried to summit on the 23rd last year, which is what created those long lines and stuff that everybody saw.
Yes, I saw the picture. Yeah. You said you went up on the north side. I heard that there was a Sherpa who passed away who was wearing some green shoes.
Oh, green boots.
Mm-hmm. And that he's still there. His body is still there. And that when there's not a lot of snowfall, you step around him. Did that happen?
Yeah. So there's about 200 bodies that are still left on Everest. I saw a couple, and it's like, you know that that's there and that's going to happen, but it's so surreal when you see it because the bodies don't decompose. So it just looks like a person. And
they're like in all their hiking gear. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's really crazy. So the first one I saw like was kind of out on the trail. So we did have to just kind of walk around. And at that point, you're just like, okay, you're praying for their family and just like friends. And then you're praying like, oh, Lord, please let me get up and down safely.
Yeah.
So
did you ever think at a certain point you were going to die?
No, but I could have, like, looking back now, I'm like, I really could have died then. But I wasn't thinking about it at the time. I think you're so, like, oxygen deprived. You're so exhausted. And your body's not thinking rationally when you're at the actual summit.
Is it
coming
true
down
that your Sherpa can send you home if he doesn't think that you're going to make it?
Yeah, your Sherpa, your guy can tell you need to turn around. And there's a lot of arguments that problems that can occur because when you are having cerebral edema and that high of oxygen, you don't know, you can't rationally think through things. So even though someone might be telling you, you need to come down, you're saying, no, I need to keep going. I'm fine. And so that sometimes causes these deaths because people can't rationalize that they're actually having a serious problem. Like they're having altitude, you know, sickness. So,
wow. Did your experience as a nurse make you more aware of your symptoms, or did it make you more vulnerable to getting injured because you're like, I know everything, everything's great?
I don't know. I don't deal too much with altitude sickness here in Florida or in Dallas. But, I mean, being aware, it makes you – I guess it does make you more aware of what you're feeling and what your body's going through. But I never felt like I was having any negative symptoms. I have – been so blessed to always do really well in altitude. So
that is really good.
Incredible.
And low oxygen, obviously, because a lot of people have long-term physical and psychological effects from summiting. Did you have any?
Not that I know of. I mean, I might be a little crazier, but
you're like, ask my family.
Yeah. I think I came home okay. I was really sick 3 to 5 days after the summit, like coughing, upper respiratory stuff. But as soon as we started to go down, I felt fine.
How long were you able to stay at the top?
So Karma and I were at the top by ourselves for about 3 minutes, which was a miracle because it was one of the busiest years on Everest. And we had been climbing up for about 20 something hours, and we climbed all through the night. So we left at like 7 at night and climbed until sunrise. So towards the end of the summit, like I could, there's a false summit kind of, and I didn't really know exactly where the summit was. But about 30 minutes before we reached it, Karma attached me from the ropes and started attaching me to these other ropes. And as we're climbing, I felt like we were running, but we were literally like step. But I was like, Karma, what are you doing? I can't breathe. Like, I'm not sure, but please stop. We're going too fast. Like, what are you doing? And little did I know, he was literally getting us around all these people so that we would be like the first people to summit. So there might have been people summit before me, or I have no idea, but there was no one up there when we got up there. So it was absolutely amazing. And the sun was rising and it was just so gorgeous.
That gives me goosebumps. Yeah. Just imagining it.
It was incredible. And then some other people started coming up and, you know, we got our pictures and videos, and my video that Karma took, I'm like, yay, let's party. And then I'm like, wait, now we have to get down. It's just like that feeling of, oh, like this is only halfway through. So then like the adrenaline's gone, you've made it to the top and you're exhausted. So climbing down was a lot scarier. It was a lot harder. And that's where a lot of deaths usually occur, on the way down.
Hey, Curiositors, just a quick pause to show gratitude to our sponsors and give you some special deals.
If you're new here, you may be surprised to know that the beautiful backdrop of my show is not a virtual screen. It's a real place that you can really rent inside of the Pensacola Museum of History. The exhibit space is called Trader John's. It's an old bar in Pensacola whose owner was just as eclectic as this town. And it's perfect for birthdays, work events, award ceremonies, retirement parties, family reunions. So don't pick another boring venue space for your next event. Give the Pensacola Historic Trust your business and make your event super memorable. Learn more at historicpensacola.org. The weather is cooling down here in the southern U.S., and that means it's fire ant season. For those of you not from the south, fire ants are about as pleasant as they sound, and their bites pus up into an itchy red mess that takes forever to heal. I recommend InSec for pest management because I've been using their mosquito service since 2019, and I love that their work is guaranteed. If you're in the Florida Panhandle or the Gulf Coast of Alabama, give InSec a call. It's ENSEC.net. Now back to the show. Remember to stay till the end where I give you a sneak peek of next week's episode.
How many days does it take to get down versus up?
That's kind of a trick question. So we were on the mountain about 53 days. So you climb to advanced base camp three different times before you even attempt to summit. So that's a 13-mile hike each way. So, I mean, hike, climb, whatever, it's long and you're going straight up. So it's exhausting. So we did that three times. Then you kind of have to wait for the weather window. So when you finally get the right weather window and you're going to make your final like summit push, you do the 13-mile hike to base camp or advanced base camp. You spend the night at advanced base camp. That's when we got our Sherpa for the final summit push. Then you go to camp one, spend the night at camp one, go to camp two, spend the night at camp two. Then from camp two, you wake up and you don't stop. So you go to camp three, you get in a tent with like, we had like five people in our little tiny tent. You try to eat whatever you can, you know, like ramen basically is what you're eating. Drink as much as you can. Go to the bathroom, do whatever you need to do, and then we started hiking, so or climbing. Get to the summit, and then from the summit, and the same, you know, you're still awake, you haven't eaten, you go all the way back down to camp one, or camp three, camp two, and you're trying to get back to camp one. So all in all, you're awake about 37 hours.
What?
With like no food, nothing to drink, and very little oxygen. And you think you want to eat and drink, and you know, Karma would take my oxygen off and try to give me water, but your body is just like, no, I don't want to be here. Your body is literally dying at that altitude. And you think like you want to eat and drink, but your body like really won't let you.
Right.
So
because it's time to die.
Yeah.
Because you're dying.
Obviously.
Because why would a human be that high?
Yeah. It's like, I don't want to be here. I'm going to try to keep your organs alive.
I can't
process eating and drinking. So basically like those 37 hours, I think, you know, when I tried to do the math, I probably had about 800 calories and you burn like anywhere from 20 to 30,000. On the final summit. So, I mean, it's pretty insane to think what your body can actually handle. And, you know, if I were to do an Ironman, I would be eating 500 to 700 calories an hour. I did that over 37 hours. So it's insane.
That is totally insane when you think about what's possible. So, I mean, I could talk forever about this. This is so fascinating to me. So if you, you said you had some insights or tips that you wanted to give our listeners on why it's never too late to start at the bottom, because I was so surprised to hear that at 38, you were like, oh, and we're going to do this, you know, and that you didn't have an athletic life prior to that. So tell us what you have to share to our listeners about starting at the bottom.
Yes. Well, I think number one, like, don't let your age define you. It doesn't matter if you're 21, 18, or 28, 38, you know, it's never too old to start. And with the right training and the right mindset, you can really do anything. And then the second is just to live a life of gratitude and be thankful that you have this body and this life to live and live it to the fullest. And there's going to be obstacles, whether you're climbing Everest or driving in traffic. But, you know, it's where you focus your energy and just overcome those obstacles with a mindset of gratitude, just being thankful even in hard situations. You know, I told my sister, like, on Everest, just embrace the suck. Like, it's going to suck, but at the end, it's going to be totally worth it. And it definitely was. And a third thing, well, I guess you're never too late to start at the bottom also, because I'm 39 and I'm about to have a baby.
What?
Surprise! I'm 3 months pregnant. So, yeah, even at 39, God, you can birth a child.
Congratulations.
So you can do anything you put your mind to.
Well, on that note, everybody,
had to top Everest somehow.
I mean, I just never know what I'm going to get with you, obviously.
Well, thank you so much. That was awesome.
And
that
truly is a wrap. Way to go.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, you'll also like the one I did with a travel writer who found out her travel plans got corona canceled mid-flight and ended up being stuck in the country of Georgia. That's episode 50. Stay tuned next week for a remastered episode with a mental health professional who helps get people out of cults.